prices rise in China.
And here in the U.S. as well.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, June 14th.
Coming up, we'll look at inflation on both sides of the Pacific.
We'll get a look at the most depressed economy in the United States.
And the grass is always browner, Steve. Why the U.S. and the U.K. are both scared of each other's healthcare systems.
Brown grass, yes. Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
New numbers out of Beijing this morning say inflation in China is at its highest level in 3 years. Consumer prices jumped 5.5% last month compared with a year earlier. Let's bring in our China Bureau Chief, Rob Schmitz. He's with us from Shanghai. Rob, how are these rising prices being felt in China?
Well, inflation tends to be the backdrop to a lot of unrest in China. In the past few days, we've seen protests by migrant workers in Guangdong province. And if there's anyone in China who feels the pinch of inflation, it's migrant workers. The little they make, they send home, leaving almost nothing for themselves. So a 5.5% rise in the price of food is a very big deal.
Well, when I hear about rising prices and protests, I can't help but think of the Arab Spring. Is there worry in China that these protests could escalate?
Well, you know, the government's worried about it for the pure reason of self-preservation. I spoke to Jeffrey Crothell today with the China Labor Bulletin, and he says we've seen other protests this year where inflation was a big factor.
They're paid very low wages. They have to work very long hours. They face discrimination. When they see one of their number is attacked or victimized, then the natural response is to react against that.
And as we've seen in the past, inflation in China has a tendency to spur social instability. It was one of the factors that led to the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989. China doesn't want a repeat of that, especially now when it's trying to focus on the delicate dance of slowing down its economy, but not slowing it down too much.
Marketplace's Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, here in the U.S., the government said this morning that wholesale prices rose by just 0.2% last month. Now, in the past year, the so-called producer price index is up by more than 7%. That is a measure of prices of the things companies or factories buy. Tomorrow, we're going to hear about prices of the things consumers buy.
Let's bring in our regular Tuesday analyst, Julie Neiman from Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, put the two stories together for us. Rising prices in China, rising prices in the U.S. There aren't any protests here in America, as far as I know, going on over rising prices. But how are these two things related?
Well, that's the big thing, because the rising food in China leads to civil unrest. Here in the United States, we're sullen but not rebellious, is what it really comes down to. China has really decided to reduce social tensions by cooling inflation but not hurting growth. Here in the United States, Ben Bernanke is taking the opposite approach. We have no inflation. We only need to work on growth and credit expansion, except that the real inflation is a tax on consumers, and that's in our cash inflation. It's very real. It's food, energy, building supplies, pharmaceuticals, and services. And this is where we're really seeing the pinch, and it's really become a class issue, low and middle class.
Well, when it comes to consumers, as you say, I mean, we heard this morning that retail sales actually fell last month in this country by 0.2%. Is that related to rising prices, do you think?
It's actually a short-term thing. We had a very brief respite from rising food prices. Summer veggies are back in. Then we had a little bit of a drop in retail sales in terms of automotive, you know, and again, that's tied to Japan.
Right.
But these are temporary things that we're looking at. What we are going to see is toward the end of the summer a significant pickup in the price of energy. That's global demand for energy, not what's driving here in the United States, but it's going to hit us right here at home and virtually everything through the production line.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Thanks as always.
You bet.
President Obama is in Puerto Rico today talking jobs and the economic recovery and hosting a campaign fundraiser. He's the first president in decades to set foot on the island, which, as Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports, is the most economically depressed place in the United States.
The Puerto Rican economy is 12% smaller than it was 4 years ago. Economists estimate nearly one-third of Puerto Ricans are out of work. Business consultant Jose Villamil says the economy's been essentially stagnant for decades.
We tried to keep a approach to economic development that ran out of gas many years ago. The world changed, the global economy changed, and we assumed that it hadn't.
Discount manufacturing center, oil refining hub, pharmaceutical hotspot. The island's tried a lot of things over the years. Now economist Dionisio Montalvo says businesses in Puerto Rico face too many obstacles.
The payment for electricity and water are high. The transportation, we don't have good transportation in Puerto Rico.
Obama's visit includes historical sites and meetings on the territory's political status, but Montalvo and Villamil say Puerto Ricans mostly want to hear about one thing, es la economía estúpido. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Word this morning that Apple will pay rival mobile phone maker Nokia an undisclosed sum of money to settle a lawsuit over patent infringement. The two companies have been locked in a legal battle since 2009. Nokia claimed Apple used its technologies in the iPhone.
A government report says U.S.-based airlines collected nearly $3.5 billion in baggage fees last year. Delta was the biggest bag charger at almost $1 billion.
Almost $1 billion. Steve, you know what else is flying high this year?
What's that?
Viewership for the NBA Finals. Sunday's series-winning game between the Mavericks and the Heat drew 23 million viewers to ABC. That is up 31% from the last game of the Finals last year.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. In Britain today, Prime Minister David Cameron will announce he is softening some of the massive reforms he'd planned for British health care. Now, interestingly, while politicians here in the U.S. say they don't want anything to do with a British-style socialized medical system, a lot of Brits are railing against going the route of the mostly private American healthcare system. Marketplace's Stephen Beer joins us now from London with more on that. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Why all the fear of American-style healthcare?
It is the great boogeyman of the British healthcare debate. I mean, many Brits have a somewhat distorted view of what happens in the US, I have to say. You know, you're knocked down by a bus, you're lying in the road, but the ambulance crew won't pick you up and take you to the hospital until they've seen your credit card. That's what many Brits believe. The point is that healthcare in the UK under the NHS is free at the point of use. So you go to the doctor's office, you go to the hospital, you have an operation, you don't pay, however rich you are. The Brits are very attached to that system and very fearful of what they see as the costly, unfair and commercialized American system.
All right, Stephen, if so many people are happy with the status quo there in Great Britain, why do leaders want to change things?
Well, because it's free at the point of use, demand's practically unlimited and costs are rising very rapidly. The NHS is heading towards a crunch and the government says it wants to contain and curb these costs by getting rid of bureaucracy, trying to get a bit more competition into the system, more private healthcare providers. But this has met huge opposition from the general population. Mark Littlewood of the Free Market Institute for Economic Affairs says it's beginning to look as if you can't reform the NHS.
Criticising it is about the moral equivalent of burning the stars and stripes in the USA. It is almost considered an unpatriotic and unacceptable thing to do or consider.
So today the Prime Minister will tone down his reform package. Mark Littlewood says that will only delay the day of reckoning for the NHS.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
The Pentagon today rolls out new plans for saving energy. That plan has nothing to do with saving polar bears or whales, but saving lives in the field and a whole lot of money. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
The Army measures the cost of energy in lives. One casualty every 24 fuel convoys in Afghanistan. In dollar terms, one study estimates $45 a gallon, factoring in transportation and military protection in hostile places. Today's announcement will incorporate various goals. The Air Force wants half its fuel to come from bio sources by 2016. The Navy plans a whole strike group, warships, submarines, jets, powered by nuclear and biofuels.
The main thing we can do is create the market.
Navy Secretary Ray Mabus says the military can help commercialize new fuels by promising to buy large amounts.
By 2020, we'll have a market of 8 million barrels of alternative fuels. As you scale up, price almost automatically comes down.
But skeptics wonder if new fuels are more than a decade away, and if this is another Pentagon fad that will fall out of fashion. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, what could be better on a hot South Texas day than an ice-cold beer? Doesn't that sound good?
I can't think of anything.
But for those who bought tickets, to the inaugural Houston Beer Festival over the weekend. Well, they were left steaming instead. Oh. Yeah. Event organizers way oversold that event, offering up 20,000 tickets to a park that could only hold 12,000 people, meaning the line to get in the park's only entrance. There was one entrance to the Beer Fest. It was at least three blocks long. And lines for beer taps, which ran dry, by the way, before day's end, took as long as half an hour. They actually ran out of water like midway Yikes. Through the event, which reminds me of some advice my bar owner dad gave me when I was a teenager. He owned a bunch of bars. And he always told me, don't anger a large crowd of hot, drunk people.
That is good advice.
Never do that.
Well, in Seattle today, a judge will hear arguments involving unionized labor and Boeing's much-discussed and much-delayed 787 Dreamliner airplane. Boeing opened up a plant last week in South Carolina to build its new fuel-efficient airplane, but it was a non-union plant. That's led to a fight between Boeing and the National Labor Relations Board. Bellamy Palethorpe has our story now from KPLU in Seattle.
Here's what the NLRB alleges. Boeing built the second assembly line for the Dreamliner in South Carolina as retaliation for past strikes by the machinist union in Washington state. And that, it says, is against the law.
It's a legally protected right, and we exercised it, and the company retaliated against us for it.
Paul Veldkamp is a shop steward for the machinist union. He's worked for Boeing 15 years now and says the company's actions have had a definite chilling effect.
People on the shop floor would come up to me after they had announced that they were moving this line to South Carolina, and they'd say, we have to have a contract next time. We can't go on strike, or they're going to send all of our jobs down to South Carolina.
Old-timers say Boeing tries with every contract to take away pay and benefits, even when it's selling record numbers of airplanes. Frederick Hoskins has worked there for 25 years. He says when top executives repeatedly defended their decision to go to South Carolina with anti-union sentiments, it was too much.
It was said over and over and over. We keep going on strike. They want to put it somewhere where that they can keep business going and stay competitive. And that's why they moved it.
There is very clear precedent, including from the Supreme Court, that companies can take the economic impact of strikes into account when making new investments.
Boeing spokesman Tim Neal says no one has lost a job in Puget Sound as a result of their new plant in South Carolina.
In fact, we've actually added 2,000 hourly union jobs in the Puget Sound region over the past year and a half.
Boeing workers in South Carolina have joined the fight against the NLRB.
They would probably board up this facility and I'd be out of work.
Dennis Murray is a quality assurance inspector at the new facility. He thinks South Carolina workers are being discriminated against because they're in a right-to-work state where unions can't be mandatory. This fight has taken on epic proportions, with attorneys general of 16 states now attacking the NLRB and Congress investigating the agency with hearings of its own. In Seattle, I'm Bellamy Palethorpe for Marketplace.
Well, New Jersey today wraps up the first round of applications on its new offshore wind project. The Garden State could be the first in the country to actually start harnessing offshore wind for power. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports from the Sustainability Desk the U.S. lags behind Europe and other countries in getting offshore wind to market.
America's windiest land is also no man's land. Wind farms in the plains and deserts need long transmission lines to get power to the people. Andy Wickless is with Navigant Consulting. He says East Coast waters are the best bet for wind power because of all the big cities nearby.
Which can be a plus and a minus. A plus in terms of the amount of transmission you have to build, a minus in terms of potential public backlash.
Backlash has held up one offshore proposal called Cape Wind for about a decade. Its developers want to put turbines in Nantucket Sound.
Greenpeace, these are the fishermen that you're trying to put out of business.
That's from a documentary about the fight. It's clean energy activists versus vacationers and local business. But public opinion's just the beginning. It's taken government agencies a long time to write offshore wind guidelines. And once wind developers do get permits, Andy Wickless says they still need other companies to build transmission lines and utilities to promise to buy the power.
If fewer folks were involved, it would probably go faster.
And motivation helps, too. New Jersey has it. Because offshore wind means work, mostly at ports. The huge blades and poles need to be assembled near the water. Jim Lenard is president of the Offshore Wind Development Coalition. He says New Jersey's willing to trade the higher price of wind power for jobs.
The developers have to show that the benefits that they're bringing to the state of New Jersey exceed the costs that the ratepayers might be asked to pay.
The first offshore turbine should start spinning next September, just six of them, in state waters near Atlantic City. New Jersey's enthusiasm for wind may seem at odds with another move. It just quit a program to trade greenhouse gases. But Jim Lenard says right now, climate change is not the way to sell wind power to lawmakers.
We recognize that their interests lie more with economic development, job creation, and manufacturing.
He says that new script should help offshore wind pick up speed. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Steve, another tech company is going public. Any idea what it is this time?
No, let's see. We've got Groupon and
Facebook, Twitter. Nope, it's Pandora this time.
Pandora!
The online music service is set to push ahead with its IPO this week and hopes to raise about $175 million. Marketplace's Steve Henn profiles the company for us.
Millions of consumers love Pandora. From the beginning, it seemed almost magical. Tell it the name of a song or artist you like, and then it delivers other music you're into. So let's say you type in the name Black Eyed Peas. You'll get this. Pandora now has more than 90 million users, but it has to pay handsomely for the rights to songs it streams, and it struggled to find a business model that works. After 10 years, it's still not quite breaking even. Paul Bard's an analyst at Renaissance Capital.
The potential and the opportunity for them is big enough that it's driving big valuations.
Bard says by running more ads, it will turn a profit. Pandora still faces a torrent of competition, from FM to Apple to satellite radio. But Bard believes it has a good shot at stealing listeners and ultimately advertising from all of them. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
And finally, what do New Orleans, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Memphis, and New York have in common?
I don't know. They're relatively large cities, right?
Large cities. Yeah. And in fact, they are America's five dirtiest cities, according to the latest Travel and Leisure magazine.
How proud they must be.
They are ranked based on things like litter, air pollution, and the taste of the local tap water, which
Ooh.
I think is kind of surprising because New York is well known for its lovely tasting tap water.
Who knows about it? What are you talking about? Well,
they
no.
are. That's what they. You know,
I think the tap water actually in LA is pretty good.
Well, there you go. LA's on the list too. I don't know. I think they're not really paying it. I think they say they care about the taste of the tap water, but in fact, that's not figuring into the argument very much. Okay. Well, you can see where your city ranks on the list at marketplace.org, but you shouldn't feel too bad, Steve, for the dirtiest city.
Which is?
New Orleans.
New Orleans, of
because
course.
Because New Orleans also ranked number one when it comes to nightlife, which yeah. I'm guessing is not a coincidence.
No. Dirt, drinking, and yeah,
a lot of garbage
around
on
Bourbon
the streets.
Street. Garbage, yeah, all of it.
Well, in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. Enjoy your Tuesday. This is The Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.